truly delighted to introduce our luncheon speaker, Stuart Baker. Stuart is one of the most creative, innovative thinkers in the world of law. In fact, when the Department of Homeland Security decided it needed a policy assistant secretary, they weren't quite sure what that job would entail or what it would insist, so they brought in Stuart to invent it from scratch, conceptualize it, staff it, give it life, and help keep us all safe. Stuart's a partner at Steptoe & Johnson. He's the author of many things, including a terrific book called Skating on Stilts, Why We Aren't Stopping Tomorrow's Terrorism, which focuses on the security challenges posed by technology and the use of data in preventing terrorism. As I mentioned, he was the first Assistant Secretary for Policy in the Department of Homeland Security. Earlier in his career, he was General Counsel of the National Security Agency, former Supreme Court clerk, and a great guy. So, Stuart, thank you.
Thanks, Vince. I'm going to talk today about cyber war and try to dig actually a little deeper into some of the themes that we've already heard about in the first panel. Is cyber war overhyped? If it's not like nuclear weapons, what is it like? And I've got an idea, and then I'm going to try to tease some lessons out of history and out of the analogies that I think are appropriate for cyber war. That leads to some questions about, well, what are we going to do about it and the prospect of cyber war? And I'll end with a discussion of what the administration has proposed by way of possible approaches to dealing with the problem of cyber war. So let's start with the first question, which is, I'm also trying out this new presentation software called Prezi. And so the only risk here is that you could get a little seasick. So be careful. We hear a lot about the question whether cyber war is overhyped, and the idea that it's overhyped is not just something that has been proposed by people outside government. We've heard that from Howard Schmidt, that he thinks that the use of the word cyber war is terrible. DHS, the deputy secretary, wrote an op-ed that said, cyberspace is not a war zone. We shouldn't be talking about cyber war. There have been a number of other folks who have made that argument, including people who wrote a report for the OECD, Bruce Schneier, and others. And I would suggest that the real problem, especially the lesson we've learned the last two or three years, is not that it's overhyped, that it's already over here, sort of like GIs in World War II England. They were over here, oversexed and over here. And I think that we're going to see, we have seen simply from unclassified reports, in 2009, the break into the Dalai Lama's system was described in great detail. It was similar to attacks that had been launched against the U.S. government for years and which had been classified and had resulted in two presidents before President Obama saying this is a serious crisis, but I can't tell you any details, to which the body politic had said, yeah, well, wake me in the morning. Now we have a completely unclassified description of how easy it was to break into the Dalai Lama's network, simply sending a targeted email from someone that one of his staffers thought he knew pretty well with an attachment that he expected to get that really was what he was expecting, and he opened it and read it. And meanwhile, the malware that was attached to it started compromising his system in ways that most antivirus software, and certainly the antivirus software the Dalai Lama was running, couldn't actually detect. This is all relatively easy to do. It could be done. This was done in 2009. It could be done today to anybody in this room. And chances are, if somebody set their mind to it, they could persuade you to open an attachment that your antivirus software didn't catch. And they would compromise your system in the way the Dalai Lama's system was compromised. I love this because it shows us that these hackers aren't 10 feet tall. They need a graphic user interface. They need like a Windows style interface to do their spying. But these are drop down menus in which the attacker is asked, what do you want to do to this compromised computer? You want to log all his keystrokes? Well, you got to just click this box. You want to turn on his microphone and turn on his camera so you can watch him and look at him while he's doing his business? You got to click these other two buttons, and then bang, we'll just do it for you. That is, you know, as I've said in other contexts, the full 1984 package. It's exactly what was happening in 1984. The only difference is the Dalai Lama had to pay for the equipment. I'm going to skip over 2010, come back to it. 2011 told us it isn't our fault. We're not being compromised because we're idiots. That was the lesson for most of the 90s and even at the turn of the this century. The notion was, well, you know, security is simple. You just have to take certain precautions, and if you take the precautions, then you won't be compromised, and the people who don't take them will be, and they're idiots, and so they get what they deserve. Well, if that's the case, we're all idiots now, because, as was said on the panel, RSA, in the business of securing communications and systems, managed to lose control of its one central business secret, the thing that it's selling to everybody, the millions and millions of little key fobs that we all use to log on, were compromised in an attack. And sure, they made mistakes, the fact that they could be compromised just because of a couple of small mistakes and in such a fundamental way suggests that we aren't going to be any better at it and nobody else is, and that's true. H.B. Gary, another security firm, was compromised in a fashion not even by a nation state but by a bunch of kids. And they found secrets in H.B. Gary that they published, and that led to the CEO getting fired, which ought to get, you know, the attention of the private sector. But it was a security firm. Nonetheless, there were a little bit of, you know, occasional flaws in their security that were enough to compromise their secrets. And even, you know, it used to be that when DOD talked about all of the attacks on their system, they'd say, oh, but don't worry, our classified systems weren't compromised. They don't say that anymore. In fact, they say the opposite. Their classified systems have been compromised by attackers. Even people in the business with enormously important secrets to protect, who ought to know what they're doing and who certainly know what best practices are not immune from attack. That means anybody can be attacked. There's nobody safe from extraction of secrets. What happened in 2010 that is, I think, significant is it's not just, we realize it's not just secrets that can be obtained by compromising networks. You can take control of the industrial control systems that run big sophisticated systems like the Natanz enrichment plant. You can persuade the controllers that are at the heart of these industrial control systems to report back to the network, the operating center, yep, boss, everything is just fine. I'm just spinning away, enriching the uranium. You'll have a bomb in no time. And in the meantime, back at the centrifuge, the controller is saying, okay, let's see if we can get up 25% above our specs, maybe 50% above our specs. Now let's drop it right to zero and then go back to 25 or 50% above. But, you know, be sure to tell the operating center that it's all just fine. And after a while, the centrifuges break, and the system doesn't operate properly. So that ability to sabotage the Natanz enrichment plant was a pretty good substitute, maybe a much more effective substitute for, you know, bunker-busting bombs that are at the edge of what very sophisticated air forces can deliver. So there's no doubt that it is a weapon that has the same effect that kinetic weapons can have. Now, if you combine those two things, you discover that we're in a situation where you can actually break into any system and then cause the industrial control systems or the computer system with the information system to stop working. And that's what causes us all to rethink the question of cyber war and what I'll be talking about today. So it seems to me that we are on the verge, as we combine all of these possibilities, of having cyber weapons that are overwhelming in their capabilities. We aren't there yet, but we can see it from here. And if you think about the prospect of using the capability to break into systems and then break the industrial control systems and the information systems, when you think about that from the point of view of a potential adversary, you see that they have enormous advantages. First, you break into your adversary's system, our system, let's say. You can sit there and watch the United States prepare to go to war, or decide maybe not to go to war, or tell them each other what their red lines will be. You can watch all of that, and you can fine-tune your response. And then if you don't get what you want, because you know what the U.S. is thinking, you can go to war. And then this system, which the United States built for its own purposes to make it the most effective military in the world, which has actually been betraying the United States throughout the process of preparing for war, completes that process by ceasing to operate just when we need it, when we need to fight a war. And when we start to send people out on net-centric critical missions, they stop being able to have confidence that they know where they are, that they're hearing from their commander, that they're reporting back to their commander, that they're getting accurate information about the situation that they face. And so the entire system works entirely for the benefit of the adversary and not for us. This is not a good thing. And that's the reason why 100 countries are window shopping for cyber weapons, and probably 20 or 30 of them are quite serious. They can all see the opportunities that this provides. So let's take a look at this from the point of view of the United States. So we're thinking about cyber war, right, and the possibility of an attack. Well, okay, so what runs on industrial control systems? This is not a surprise. Power plants, including nuclear power plants, run on it. Refineries run on it. Sewers run on it. Pipelines run on it. Water supplies run on it. If you can attack the systems that control that, if you can get the pipelines and the sewage and the water systems all to report false data to their operators and instead to try to break themselves, you're going to have a massive civilian disaster on your hands. And so if you ask the question, well, will cyber weapons work? I think the question is against us. Well, duh, of course they would work. Everybody in the world knows how to fight the United States if you can do it. First, you got 6 months to actually prepare to fight the United States before they can do anything serious, or maybe it's 2 months, but there's a long logistics tail that the U.S. has to gear up. And then you have to withstand the shock and the awe, and then you have to wait a year, 2 years, 10 years for Americans to get tired of the war. And then they'll leave. And this is, you know, that's the way to fight if you can manage to do it. Now, imagine that that process of getting tired of the war began before we could move the first boatload of equipment into your neighborhood so that instead of having the demonstrations 3 years after the war began, people are feeling pain the day that you announced that you're moving the logistical material to the neighborhood to potentially fight the war. That's the way to beat the United States. If you were a middle-sized or smallish country that the United States hated, why would this not be your plan? And what would make the Americans more tired faster of a war than having their lights go out and stay out for a month because of some liberation front that is in sympathy to with the country that has actually launched the attack? That's why I think that this is such a serious and plausible weapon. Now, we talked a little bit about the question of what is cyber war like, and are cyber weapons like nuclear weapons? And I think the answer is no, they're better. They're better in a number of ways, but the most obvious is you can use them. Somebody has used them already multiple times around the world, and they have had effects and valuable effects to the people fighting the war. So there's no massive taboo against the use of cyber weapons, and therefore the use of them, plus the ability to deny that you used them, makes them a very attractive early weapon, potentially one that is used in preference to a variety of kinetic weapons. Instead of nuclear weapons, it seems to me that what cyber weapons are really like, and the analogy that I'd like to dig into for the second part of this discussion, is they're like air power. In many respects, but here are a few. Obviously, air power is, unlike nukes, a weapon you can use. Air war sometimes can be deniable, but actually cyber weapons are better in that regard even than air power, as is the asymmetry that comes with that. The other thing that I think is relevant about air power is it is a sidecar on your commercial economy. The kinds of things your commercial economy allows you to do allows you to develop effective military aircraft. It's not perfect, but certainly in the first 50 years of the development of air power, it was directly connected to your power as an economy, how well you could develop weapons that flew. And finally, it moves fast. If you go back and look at the history of air power, it transformed war in a period of a couple of generations, 30 years probably. First, I mean, we've had a failure of imagination in this country about these weapons. It took H.G. Wells 5 years from the first heavier-than-air flight at Kitty Hawk to write a book, best-selling book, about the air war, in which New York City was destroyed by bombs dropped from airships. And that vision of death and destruction from the air and the inability of the United States to protect itself by virtue of its great oceans became themes of air power right from the start. And within 10 years, people were flying planes in war. And again, like cyber weapons, their first use was not to cause harm, but to gather intelligence, flying above the lines, figuring out what people were doing on the other side, and reporting back. Sure, people fired pistols at each other and occasionally dropped a pineapple bomb from the cockpit, but basically it was an intelligence weapon in World War I. But the idea, the vision that H.G. Wells had of death from the skies came true within 20 years of that. Guernica, when the Germans tried out their this theory of war on a small village in Spain during the Spanish Civil War, and it captured everybody's imagination. I'm not going to play the YouTube video here, but there is a moving footage, it's about a minute long, of the Prince of Wales and Repulse, which 4 years after Guernica, you know, the British for 150 years figured as long as they had more ships than anybody else, more and bigger ships, they could dominate the seas and prevent attacks on their homeland and squeeze their opponents even on the European mainland. And they were right until 1941, when some of the biggest, best, most effective ships that the British had, Prince of Wales and Repulse, were destroyed from the air by Japanese forces. And an era ended there, and it ended pretty fast. And what I guess I would suggest is that this is, you know, the first lesson that you can draw from the air war analogy is that it doesn't take long. 30 years is a long time in the development of new weapons to lose all the advantages that you've had for 150 years in the case of the British, or for 65 years in the case of the United States. If this is a serious weapon, and I think it is, the possibility that it can take away all the advantages that we've come to depend on and all the things that we've just assumed about how wars will be fought is very real. So that's lesson one. Lesson two, I'd like to go back a few years in history to what people thought about as they began to contemplate what war from the air would actually be like. Because the folks who thought about war in the 30s, those who weren't still in the throes of believing there never would be one or should never be one, were remarkably clear-eyed. Stanley Baldwin was a prime minister, I think, twice in Great Britain. Here's what he told people in 1932. It's well for the man in the street to realize there's no power on earth that can protect him from being bombed. Whatever people may tell him, the bomber will always get through. We'll talk a little bit about why he believed that, but the most chilling statement is what he says next. The only defense is an offense, which means you've got to kill more women and children more quickly than the enemy if you want to save yourselves. Very stark view of what war from the air would likely mean. I can't help contrasting that with our current leadership, who reassure us that cyberspace is not a war zone, and who I would award a very special bumper sticker for their grasp of the situation. The other thing that is interesting about this is how it aligns remarkably with the adversary that was most often mentioned on the panel today. Here's what the People's Liberation Army Daily said last week. Our country's developed into an internet great power. Our internet security defenses, though, are still weak. We have to accelerate development of battle technology and armament and improve our ability to defend internet frontiers. I think that's what's interesting about that. And the second lesson here is that everybody agrees that cyber war is like the vision of air war in the 1930s. The hacker will always get through. We heard Colonel Brown say that the offense has the advantage in cyber war. And this is for sure true, because nobody has been able to protect anything, as far as we're able to tell thus far, in efforts to keep out the spies. There's no reason to believe we'll be able to prevent sabotage. Now, third thing I'd like to talk about in this context is, so what did these guys in the 30s do about this? This is a stark and chilling glimpse of a world that you don't really want to live in, and a war you probably really don't want to fight. So there's several responses that one could take to this. You can build up your attack capability, kill more of their women and children before they kill yours. You can work on defenses. The French had a lot of defenses that they worked on. You can, this is a uniquely American and 21st century solution, you can lawyer up, you can negotiate deals, and we've talked about all of that. I want to talk a little bit about the law part of this because I think it bears repeating, it shouldn't, but we're in a funny era. There was lots of international law war, and real international law war, not just some Swiss law professor talking. There was a Hague Convention on the Law of War that said, do not attack civilian infrastructure, edifices devoted to religion, art, science, charity, hospitals, places where the sick and wounded are collected, should not be attacked unless they're simultaneously used for military purposes. And on, you should not attack undefended villages and towns, et cetera, et cetera. So there was plenty of law that should have restricted the use of bombers to destroy cities. More than that, if you think, as I tend to, that the law of war is really just what the combatants agree on in any particular war, the red lines they all agree they're not going to cross, like treatment of POWs, like the use of poison gas in World War II, those are things that everybody agreed they weren't going to do. Well, there was an effort in the air war to establish a norm, at least, that we aren't going to do the kinds of things that Stanley Baldwin and H.G. Wells envisioned. So Hermann Göring, right, not one of history's softies, says to the Luftwaffe, I don't want you to attack their cities. Unnecessary loss of life among the civilian population is to be avoided. I want you to attack military targets. He says this in June of 1940, and that's what they do. But, bombs fall on London, that happens, right? Mistakes happen. And at least that's how it looks from Germany. If you're in London, it looks a little different. And the British, like the Americans in the Doolittle raids, say, okay, we will move heaven and earth to drop bombs on Berlin. And so they do. They say, you see how this works? Two can play at this game. To which Hitler says, this is by September of 1940, Hitler says, okay, that is how it's going to work. One bomb on Berlin, 10 on London. That's what I want you to do. They shift their priorities. They start bombing London. The devastation is substantial. Not surprisingly, the British remember that 10-for-1 deal when they get over Dresden 4 years later. And by that point, all this talk about law and restraints and understandings is out the window. You've got Bomber Harris, the chief of the British Air Force, saying, we want to unambiguously state that the destruction of German cities, the killing of German workers, the disruption of civilized life throughout Germany is the aim of the offensive. It's not just a side effect. The creation of a refugee problem on an unprecedented scale, breakdown of morale at home and at the battlefronts, these are the intended aims of our bombing policy. So they've gone in 4 years from saying, oh, we don't want to live in that world, to saying that is the world we embrace with enthusiasm. So what does that tell us about the prospect that cyber weapons, which can destroy civilian infrastructure to a remarkable degree, what does it tell us about the likelihood that that's going to happen? I think it certainly tells us that all this talk about the law of war is not going to work. It's too easy to launch little attacks that are misunderstood, that cause a little more harm than you intended, that strike targets that weren't quite what you had in mind, and Stuxnet certainly infected massive numbers of systems beyond Natanz, didn't happen to cause serious damage. good luck, but nonetheless, it is everywhere, and there were reports that were probably fog of war, that it had caused Indian satellites to go out of orbit and things of that sort. But in the real fog of war, there are going to be misunderstood signals about where those red lines are, and we're likely to see a rapid escalation of the use of this, and then that means that the capabilities, the possibilities that we see here for impact on civilians are hard to avoid, and certainly the lawyers aren't going to save us. So that takes us back to the four ideas. Well, there's three left, right? We can build our attack capability, build our defenses, negotiate deals. I'll come back to negotiation, and I'm not going to spend too much time on attack. This observation, everybody likes talking about attacks. Everybody likes thinking about attacks. Maybe this is unique to the American military. I don't think so. It's just more fun to take the offense. And so the enthusiasm of people who do offensive operations of whatever sort for their technology is unbounded. The idea that air war, that bombing could win the war, was a widely debated prospect during World War II because the people who flew were so sure that their technology was so cool that they could do anything. And so the enthusiasm for saying, I've got this great attack weapon, surely it's good for scaring off people who might attack us. And I think the answer to that is, well, yeah, who exactly are you going to attack with this really cool capability if you can't figure out who is attacking us, which is currently the case. And so the idea that you can do this, you can deter an attack with your great offensive capability, strikes me as flawed at heart. And of course, as we saw, that strategy leads to the summer of 1940, in which people say, oh, we can do that too, you know. And in the end, takes you to Dresden. So let me turn, I know there's lots of interesting stuff to say about attack, but I'll save it for questions. Let's take the question of how do you defend. Remember what Baldwin said, the bomber will always get through. Remember what the U.S. military and the Chinese military currently think, which is that we got great offenses, our defenses suck, there's an inherent bias toward the offense. You know, that turned out not to be quite true in World War II. The reason the bomber always got through is by the time you see his planes, it's too late to get your fighters in the air and shoot them down before they get to their targets. And so the idea of defense, you could shoot them down after they came back, but your cities were burning. And that notion depended on the assumption that you couldn't get your fighters in the air fast enough to meet and defeat the bomber fleets that were coming at you. But of course, radar made it just barely possible to do that. And that possibility was what the British exploited to win the Battle of Britain. What that says is, even though it looks like on our current structure with respect to cyber weapons, even though it looks as though there's an inherent advantage for the offense, we can't accept that. We can't accept it because of the horrible world that results. We can't accept it because it's so asymmetrically imposed upon the United States by, you know, punk nations. It is something that we simply should not accept. We need to find ways to do defense, and we need to look for technological breakthroughs that will change that dynamic the way radar changed it in World War II. I won't spend much time on this, but Einstein ain't it. The idea that this, you know, this network defense we're working on is going to change the nature of the advantage the offense has, I think, is a joke. Even if we extended it and inspected every packet that entered the United States, I don't believe that that's enough. We need more. We need to spend more and think out of the box about defenses for this to work. And I don't have a solution. I'm just telling you that I think that's something, given how bad the alternative is, that we should be spending a lot of time on. Other things that I think that the administration, the government ought to be doing, obviously, it would be nice to have leaders who would tell it to us straight and who wouldn't be afraid of fear-mongering accusations, but would say, you know, we have a really serious problem here, and telling us that cyberspace is not a war zone, I don't think is advancing our understanding of the problem we face. So we're in this deep hole. At least we could stop digging. And here I just point to a couple of things. The smart grid. We are spending billions of dollars out of the stimulus to attach our electric grid to the internet, to make it possible, if you have control of the network that the power company uses, to reach into people's homes and turn off the power to individual homes, to individual appliances. The idea that somebody, and now let's take it out of the military realm and just start with LulzSec or Anonymous. If they could turn off every refrigerator belonging to somebody that worked for the Department of Homeland Services or Homeland Security, or if your politics are reversed, everybody who works for the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms, of course they would do it. And we are enabling that kind of thing if we adopt the smart grid without adequate security. I have yet to see anybody who plausibly argues that the security will be adequate to the kinds of risks that we're adding in the smart grid. Second thing, telecommunications. If you like having foreign powers in your computer networks, then you're going to love having them in the phone system, too, so that they can actually listen to you on the phone, too, instead of having to break into your computer and turn on your mic. And we are in the process of allowing state-connected Chinese companies sell telecommunications gear that will end up at the heart of some of our telecommunications networks all across the United States, as they have already across most of the rest of the world, because we don't have any ability, the lawyers will tell you. Now, there's no legal authority particularly to prevent them other than threatening the big carriers with the possibility that the Defense Department won't use them to carry Defense Department communications. The lack of authority over telecommunications equipment is staggering in the current world, given the risks that we face. And then we're going to need to deal with the problem that has been bruited about here earlier of market failure, and the fact that most of the technologies that I described earlier are in private hands, and their security depends on private security decisions and investment decisions that the U.S. has, the government has no real ability to influence, and yet those failures of those security measures could drag the United States into war, cause it to lose a war or abandon a war because of the impact on the civilian population. So we're going to need to engage with more authority with the private sector. So let me now turn and try to finish up in the next 10 minutes or so with what the administration's proposals to deal with these problems have been. And I'm going to be critical of the administration, but I don't mean to be critical in comparison to the administration that I was in or the administration that came before that. We've had three presidents who said this was a crisis, and two of them did not do very much about it. And what's fair to say about this administration is they have taken this problem more seriously and grappled more directly with many of these issues than past administrations. They just haven't grappled effectively, in short. Lawyering up. We are still, unfortunately, lawyering up, notwithstanding how well that worked out in World War II. I've had discussions with high-ranking generals and defense officials where I say, what's our strategy? And the answer is, I don't know. I'm waiting for the lawyers to tell me what I can do. This is crazy. You got to figure out what you can do and then get the lawyers to tell you it's okay. That's the way most government lawyering works. And, you know, if they really feel that this is wrong, they'll tell you. But to ask them in the abstract what you can do and can't do is a guarantee of getting a bunch of lawyers' military advice, which I can't imagine something worse, and getting very conservative lawyers' military advice. And yet we have been stuck in that, partly because of the tradition of the last 25 years of overrating the law of war as a driver of military decisions, and also because there have been turf fights in which the law has been deployed by one agency against another. The classic one is the argument that most of the preparations for war in cyberspace, which you obviously want to hide, don't want to know, let people know who is doing it. That sounds to the CIA like covert action. And they do covert action. The military doesn't do covert action. The military does traditional military affairs. And as soon as you say, well, what's a traditional military affair, you'll find plenty of lawyers who say, I can tell you what that is. It's something that complies with the law of war as I understand it. And now you're in an era where people can make a wide variety of law of war arguments that have real binding impact on what the Defense Department can do. And you've got the State Department and the CIA who are happy to say, yes, I want to put those limits on DOD because that either serves my diplomatic purposes or my bureaucratic interests as the maven of covert action. I do think, I have to say, I think we're getting past this slowly, and that's the good news, that the idea that we should wait for the lawyers is slowly breaking down, the lawyers are slowly realizing that they don't really want this responsibility, and so more territory is being ceded to the operators, the people who actually fight wars, but it's a very slow and dangerous process. Attack. So the fundamental attack problem is not how to do it well. We're great at that. But who to attack? How to attribute the people who the attacks against us to somebody that we can then attack? The administration, I think, has come to understand that whether you're talking about cyber war or cyber crime, attribution is critical. We need better sense of who we're dealing with in cyberspace, and the administration has come up with a national strategy for trusted identities in cyberspace, which is meant to improve attribution and ability to identify people who are actors in cyberspace. And so, in my view, the good part of this is that it acknowledges we have a problem and that better attribution is important. But the bad news is it really forecloses attribution as a universal principle without having any idea how it's going to make the system work without that. The strategy goes out of its way to say, we're not going to touch anonymity or even pseudonymity because those are what? Vital to protect free speech and freedom of association. So we're taking that off the table. What's on the table that will work? We don't know. We just take it off the table because we just will not go there. But it seems to me that if the alternative is bad enough, we shouldn't be taking that off the table until we have something that we know works. Negotiations. Again, I think the administration deserves a lot of credit for actually saying, okay, so we have to have a strategy, we have to approach the question of international negotiations seriously, interagency, and write down what our beliefs are. So having one, it's a good idea. Even better, the arms limitation ideas that were floating out there as, you know, maybe we could negotiate arms controls, I don't see a lot of that in this document. And so the fear that maybe people would sign up to something that only the U.S. would end up observing because we couldn't catch people breaking the treaty. I don't see a lot of that. And nobody's actually saying what we need is a new law of war, set of rules that tell us what we can and can't do, like the Hague Convention that worked so well in World War II. That's the good parts. The bad parts are pretty much everything else. There's no talk about laws of war, but there's lots and lots of talk about norms, which is, you know, a sort of light version of laws of war. And probably there's enough, in my view, norms already. And we shouldn't be smuggling law of war concepts into this when, in the end, we can't have any assurance that they'll be observed when push comes to shove. And maybe more troubling here is the effort to take off the table. Again, everybody wants to take stuff off the table without having an alternative. And here what the State Department, what the strategy takes off the table is free flow of information. I love this line. States do not and should not have to choose between the free flow of information and the security of their networks. In what world is that true? They just say, this is ipsy-dixit, we don't have to choose. Well, you know, that makes it easy. The best cybersecurity solutions are dynamic, adaptable, have minimal impact on network performance. They secure systems without crippling innovation, suppressing freedom of expression, or impeding global interoperability. Yeah, that's right. And they should bring me apple pie in the morning every day. I mean, yes, that would be the best solution, but there's no reason to believe that any of that is true because we've never seen a security system that works. And finally, the notion that other approaches like national-level filters and firewalls provide only an illusion of security. Remember what the People's Liberation Army Daily said about that. Our defenses aren't good enough. We have to secure our internet borders. So here at last we see a deviation in view between the U.S. approach to this and the Chinese approach. The Chinese still believe that they can defend their borders, and the U.S. has taken that off the table in this international strategy. I don't know who's right, but I would suggest that nobody else does, and certainly the drafters of this don't know that defending our borders won't work. The idea that we should take it off the table because it's inconvenient is, I think, myopic. And here I want to go back to the notion that sometimes the generals fall in love with the offensive weapons and want to use them and think they'll do everything that can be done, and they want to ignore the downside. I think some of that is what's going on here, too, that the State Department has become enamored of the idea that they can use cyberspace to break down the borders of authoritarian countries, to encourage revolution, to spread democracy. And many of those things are true. I'm not suggesting that any of that is false. It's an offensive weapon that the State Department can use, which, you know, is always exciting. They're always happy to use the military, and to have their own weapon is even cooler. But in their enthusiasm for making sure they can use that weapon, I don't think they're paying much attention to how we would actually defend the country if somebody attacked us. The enthusiasm for the offense has overwhelmed planning for the defense. Another bumper sticker award. And then let me talk about the three big legal, or four big legal proposals that have come out of the administration in response to this. The first idea was to amend the Computer Fraud and Abuse Act. I don't know if Orrin Kerr has arrived here yet. Hi, Orrin. You'll get a chance to talk about this. I would characterize this as still shooting in the dark, but we got a bigger gun. The Computer Fraud and Abuse Act has the distinction of having, I believe, more prosecutor-friendly amendments per year compared to the number of actual successful prosecutions by prosecutors in the entire 18 USC. Maybe there's a child porn law that matches that. But it's been amended 10 times. This would be 11th Amendment since it was passed in 1984. There have probably been 60 or 70 successful prosecutions, guilty pleas and the like against hackers. And that's because every time it's amended, it ain't amended because the defense bar is demanding it. They're perfectly happy. They don't have to defend it very many cases. It's the prosecutors. Every time somebody says, we have a crisis with hackers, the prosecutors say, well, maybe you could make the law easier for me. It's so easy now. Everybody in this room could be indicted, and when the administration is through, for a felony. Because all it really takes is that you do something unauthorized on a system. Really, this is, you violate a rule, any rule on the system, right? If you go to check your Hotmail on a system that where the rule is you're not supposed to do that, you're in violation of the Computer Fraud and Abuse Act. If you go on Facebook and you send pictures of yourself in your underwear, I'm sure that you're in violation of the terms of service of Facebook. And so you're in violation of the Computer Fraud and Abuse Act, or at least plausibly. So the prosecutors have exactly what they want, which is a statute where they can pick anybody and make them a criminal. They still can't find the guys. This is the problem. It's not that they don't have prosecutive tools. They don't have detection tools. The attribution problem is causing all this pain. And we don't have, and these changes are, they wanted a law with meat, and they got hamburger helper here, I think. And it's worse than that. I suspect, and I'll talk to Oren about this, that we're going to discover unintended consequences of this. The big new thing here is we're going to make them subject to RICO, the racketeer-influenced corrupt organization law that allows people to, the prosecutors, once they've convicted you of the felony, they can massively increase the penalties. You have to conspire with somebody, so there has to be a willing recipient of your underwear shot, but that would do it. And you have to send it twice. And then I think you've probably got a RICO violation. Okay, so if you trust prosecutors, and I mostly do, then that's not the end of the world. But RICO has a private right of action, and I'm not convinced that, Tony Weiner isn't at risk of a RICO suit if this passes, because certainly the recording industry of America could decide they're going to use this to bring treble damage actions against people who have violated the terms of service of websites to share music unlawfully. And I'm not sure that's what we had in mind when we decided to solve the cybersecurity problem. Second thing that the administration does is they propose a federal data breach law, which would replace the 47 state laws that currently require that you notify people whose personal information has been disclosed in a data breach. this is probably a kind of useful cleanup of the law, because 47 states can't agree on everything, and if you have a big national data breach, you have a lot of problems figuring out exactly who and how and when to tell people about it, and having a federal law would be helpful. I can't help noticing that it has two effects that the Justice Department may have been happy with, or at least one. It drives lots of people toward encryption. Because if you encrypt the data, you don't have to disclose the fact that it was compromised, because the person who compromised it still can't read it. And if you want to take advantage of that safe harbor, you also have to have logs that allow you to show where these hackers went and what happened on your network for the last 6 months. Now, the administration has been waiting. That's not the administration. The Justice Department and the FBI have been looking for 5 years to get what the law enforcement in Europe has, which is a requirement for data retention. With this law, the data retention requirement will come slipping in my view, because everyone will be incentivized to keep data for at least 6 months in case they have a data breach. May have been unintended, but I think it's an interesting outcome. I think the big problem here is described below. It's the what I call the Popeye problem, and we were already seeing this. Popeye's famous for his big, brawny forearms and his little, skinny biceps. Something similar is happening in security. All of the money in security, not all, but large chunks of the money in security, the first dollar you spend goes into encrypting your laptop hard drives. So when predictably your executives and other folks leave their laptops in the airport or someplace else, and they are picked up by somebody who would like a new laptop who probably immediately reformats the drive, but they don't know that, so they have to ask, well, was there any personally identifiable information on the hard drive? And if there was, we're going to have to go out and base ourselves before 47 attorneys general. And so rather than do that, why don't we spend our first security dollar on the encryption of the hard drive so we can say we don't have to report that because the guy who's reformatting the drive can't read what's on there now. And so rather than spending money keeping people from doing the sort of spear phishing attacks that allow them to install the full 1984 package on our computers, people are spending the money making sure that they don't have to embarrass themselves by disclosing massive breaches of data that may or may not actually have existed. And I think we will still see that if we have a national law. Last big piece of legislation from the administration were regulatory proposals. There's a very substantial authority given to DHS over other agencies in the government to basically bring them into line with a coordinated architecture of security, much like DOD has for all of its agencies. On the whole, I would say this is pretty brawny, robust legislation, worth doing. It's Popeye's forearm. When we get to DHS's authority over the private sector, and DHS is given the authority, it seems pretty clear the administration started with the Collins-Lieberman bill, which basically had a kind of best practices. DHS can ask people who are in critical infrastructure what their plan is, and if it's not good enough, tell them to improve it. They started with that and watered it down substantially at all points. And I won't go through all the details, but I think broadly speaking, the private sector has to come up with a framework. The administration will find not an auditor, but an auditor's auditor that will set up standards for determining what auditors ought to do. Then the auditors will be hired by the guys who are coming up with plans to tell whether their plans match the framework that was come up with by the private sector. And then if DHS wants to, they can ask, how you doing? If they don't think that the industry is really living up to the framework, they can say so. They can't fine anybody, they can't take away licenses, they can't impose financial penalties of any sort, but they can push you, but they also can't tell you exactly what you're supposed to be doing. They can say, it's like 20 questions, that's not good enough. And you have to say, well, would this be good enough? Would that be good enough? So the prohibition on specific measures will make it difficult for DHS to actually tell people, this works, do this. Then on the question, the fundamental question of how do we get products into our commercial off-the-shelf military system that we trust? How do we make sure that the subcomponents of the subcomponents are still going to perform in war? The only authority that's given to anybody in the government is DHS is given the authority to work with the Federal Acquisition Regulatory Council to deal with that problem. Now, why you would need legislation to say that, why you couldn't send a handwritten note from the president's desk to the Federal Acquisition Regulatory Council, which works for him, and say, would you work with DHS on it? I don't know. Well, I do, because this is legislation designed to prevent the enactment of anything that actually does something more serious about this. The Federal Acquisition Regulatory Council consists of people who want more competition and less restrictions on acquisition than there is today, and they're not going to be enthusiastic about new supply chain restrictions that make it harder for them to find products that they can buy. And so I don't think this is going to do anything about the supply chain risks. It does seem to me that this is obviously a, you know, compared to the authority that DHS has to improve civilian agency security, pretty much the bicep of the product, and a remarkable achievement because, unlike, you know, the Collins-Lieberman effort was designed to find a way to regulate faster than the 18 to 36 months that Paul Rosenzweig mentioned. This thing, with all of the framework organizations and organizations to watch the auditors, is far more complex than any other approach we've taken. Rube Goldberg has, I think, finally achieved a solution to the security problem. And then last, are we still digging? I think we are still digging, and we're deeper than ever. We've done nothing about smart grid security in the legislation. We've done nothing about telecom equipment. And so that's very broadly, I think, a summary of what is good and bad about the administration legislation proposal. And a quick summary, I don't think cyber war is a hype. I think it's as real and as inevitable as air war. The U.S. is going to be the prime target. The hacker, as things stand today, will always get through. We civilians will suffer desperately as a result of that if it happens, and we're not going to get saved by lawyers and diplomats. We're going to get saved by good military strategy. If we're going to fight, we're going to have to do something about anonymity on the internet, because if we can't find the people we're fighting, we can't win. We're going to have to find ways to defend our networks much more effectively and with new technology than we have up to now. And the administration's proposals thus far, while I think they're a substantial improvement over what's been done up to now, they're still very timid and halting approaches to the problem of how we're going to defend our network against what could be a devastating attack. And my last plea is we shouldn't be taking options off the table until we know that we've got some plausible options on the table, and I don't think we're there yet. Let me stop there. Thanks.